From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If you think that managing invasive plants in a garden is a challenge, imagine that on a larger scale, a much larger scale, like today's guest faces in the name of supporting native habitat on nature conservancy land. From barberries and multiflora rose bushes to the nasty annual grass called stiltgrass, Angela Saroy Patel and her team have faced them all. More about the thinking that goes into tackling invasives in a moment, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, Small Gift Books, illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Angela Saroy Patel is a conservation biologist who serves as stewardship manager for the Nature Conservancy in the Southern Berkshires of Massachusetts. Her role there ranges from tackling invasive species, which is our topic today, to helping save endangered bog turtles. So welcome, Angela, and so good to speak to you again.
Great, thanks for having me this morning. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah, we recently collaborated on a New York Times garden column about stiltgrass. Oh my, and we'll get to that. But first, I just wanted a little context to know a little bit more about the work you do, because it's not just plants, it's habitats. It's like I just was mentioning, turtles, for instance, is one thing. So tell us a little bit about the breadth of the work.
Yeah, so, you know, the work involved in stewarding conservation lands or preserves is very diverse. And I think that's, you know, what I love most about the job. My passion for conservation and wildlife is really what brought me to stay in the Berkshires. That's where I grew up. I've really enjoyed just the diversity of things. You know, I got into some of this work with my excitement for turtle conservation and bog turtle conservation in particular, but I learned very quickly that when you want to work with wildlife, so much is about the habitat and the plants and the water.
Yes.
and the bigger systems. They're fun, great, cute little creatures to study and protect, but it really comes down to the plants so much. And so I quickly realized how much I had to, you know, improve my botanical skills and learn a lot of native species and invasive species and kind of understand how all of the plants, you know, work together to support the wildlife that, we're so attached to.
Yes. So words like weed versus invasive. Tell us a little bit about, as a person involved in this kind of conservation work, how do you regard these words? Like, when you identify an invasive, you know, kind of what are you thinking about? And because in a lot of gardeners, you know, we say weeds, but then some of them are technically also regarded as invasive plants on a larger scale and so on and so forth. So
So I would say, like, invasive plant management is kind of like weeding on like an ecological scale.
Ah.
Kind of like much bigger, you know, much bigger garden. And so I think that's kind of the way I generally type to frame it. And that invasive plants are plants that, you know, sometimes they can be native, and, you know, often the ones that we're working with are non-native, meaning they don't, you know, originate in the Northeast where we're based or wherever you happen to be managing land. And so,
right.
Invasive is that these are really super competitor plants. They have like a lot of unique reproductive strategies. They're highly competitive. They're very aggressive and vigorous. And so they are actually pretty impressive plants. But when they get a foothold where you don't really want them, that's when they become invasive. And they really push out, often pushing out native vegetation or just changing the structure. So where you maybe had like, you know, an open understory under a forest, now you have a dense shrub layer. So that kind of, those kind of changes that you see, similar to like in a garden when it, you know, a plant growing somewhere that you don't want it because you want something else to be growing there.
Right.
Yeah.
And it can not only take up this invader can not only take up territory, but it can prevent the next generation of the desired plants from successfully seeding, you know, going through their seedling and growth process. I mean, it's so many repercussions. And then, as you said at the very beginning, the creatures, the animals from insects on up, who depend on that food web that the plants are, you know, super important in, you know, that's all interrupted. So
exactly. Yeah. And it's, and you know, the study of invasive plants, like kind of the invasive plant ecology field, has really grown tremendously in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years that I've been, you know, working in conservation. And it's just amazing what they can understand for the impacts of these plants now, and everything from like changing the soil and even kind of like the synergies between some of the invasive plants together, or the invasive insects, like the jumping worm and its connectedness to like some of the other invasive plants, or, you know, the barberry's connectedness to increased tick populations, and how it, you know, different plants can change fire regimes. Like they really have these cascading impacts throughout the system.
Yes. So is the first step then, I mean, you know, I'm fascinated by quote weeds, or, you know, by the power of them, which you just kind of referred to, and their strategies. And so my first question when I encounter a plant I don't know that seems to be behaving in a weedy way is I want to know like its biology, like its life history, like how it operates and what's its special superpower. You know what I mean? Like
absolutely.
You know, field bindweed, you know, has roots that go down like 20 feet or more, and the much loathed garlic mustard with so many tactics, you know, profuse amount of seeds, as well as this allelopathic chemical, you know, warfare it conducts in the soil. Oh my goodness. They have so many power. So do you, when you're, before you start tackling something, getting to know it, is that what you do? Do you sort of do that research?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, like when I first encountered stiltgrass, that was like, it was, you know, lots and lots of research. Okay, what is this plant? Is it an annual? Is it a perennial? Like, what does it, you know, what kind of habitat is it going to thrive in? And what are its patterns for expansion? Like, where do I need to really focus in on, like, to be watching for it to show up or for it to spread into? So that's always like the first step with, especially with some of these new invasives that, you know, aren't part of our normal repertoire that we've been managing, you know, for the last couple of decades. And so I think, but, you know, just like every plant has, you know, a lot of these invasive plants do have a superpower. They usually have some weakness. There's something, you know, and,
right.
And so that's where there's a, you know, a very huge intersection between practitioners like myself and the research field, you know, working together collaboratively to kind of understand, you know, how do we find the weak points for these species, and whether that's a time of year control, a specific control method, a biocontrol agent, any of those is, you know, kind of a constant ongoing battle.
Right. So some of the, before we get to stiltgrass, some of the, I mean, I live in the adjacent area to where you work. So I'm on the Berkshires of Massachusetts is kind of also the southern part of the Berkshires is where the northwest bit of Connecticut and part of New York State kind of come together. And so I'm on the New York side. And so I know the area that you're working in, and, you know, the kinds of invasives that I see along the roadsides here and experience in my own garden trying to seed in, you know, things, as I said in the introduction, as big as barberry shrubs and multiflora rose and privet and, you know, these woody invaders. You in these large properties that you're managing, you must have a lot of issues with those big guys. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, in our specific region, we kind of have two factors that have really contributed to the explosion of invasives that we have here. One is, you know, our agricultural kind of history and, you know, current experience with, you know, most of our forests were pastures for, you know, 70 to 100 years ago for
right.
sheep, or our forests were clear for the coal industry. So, you know, these are younger forests. And so they, a lot of these forests are young and they've had more recent disturbance. And so all of those disturbance events have allowed the invasives to definitely get more of a foothold, especially around the edges. And then also, the Berkshire Mountains are, you know, have a lot of calcium deposits in the geology here. And so the kind of the rich soils that we have surrounding the Berkshire Taconic Range also make it, you know, really nutrient rich for invasives, as well as a lot of the rare native plants too. That's why they're found here as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, those two factors they work together to create a lot of invasives. And so, you know, when I first started, it was, it was pretty daunting to come into, you know, kind of managing so many thousands of acres of land that just were already well invaded. And it really kind of was depressing at first. But I think the way that, you know, I've managed it, and I, you know, teach my seasonals and interns and all the, you know, people that come and work for us over the summer times, is just like, you know, we have to be really focused and prioritized and strategic about where we do our invasive control work, because we can't do it everywhere. They're, you know, they are here, those, the Barberry and multiflora rose, bittersweet, like they're here to stay. Like eradication is not an option for those species.
Right.
It's more about, you know, where can we not have them take over? And those are going to be in our areas that are most vulnerable and have our most rare species. You know, that's where we focus a lot of our work. Or, right. And then on the new invaders, like, you know, my colleague likes to say, like, what if you found the first ever barberry plant or bittersweet vine? Like, wouldn't you want, you know, to make sure you didn't let it get a foothold in your yard?
Right. So, and you told me when we spoke for the New York Times piece, for instance, I mean, a plant I hadn't thought of as a potential invasive, Primula japonica, I think it was one of the primulas that a lot of gardeners like, and you're encountering something, oh, it's so pretty, right? But guess what? In the right spot, it's out of control. And so tell us like about something like that, because.
Yeah, that was a new one for us that my colleague, Rennie Wendell, he started seeing, you know, in like, what is this flower? And just seeing it everywhere. So it's like always, we're pretty used to the stuff we see. And so when he all of a sudden kind of starts seeing something a little bit more common than used to, we really like jumped on it. And it, you know, likely did escape from a lot of gardens because it is this beautiful flowery plant that does well in wet areas, which is now invading a lot of these rare open wetlands that we have a lot of rare sedges or rushes or, you know, a lot of these other delicate plants that just wouldn't be able to, you know,
to stand up to it. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah. So aggressive. I mean, we used to, when I first started, we did a lot of battling against purple loosestrife. And I've been so grateful of the, you know, the success of that biocontrol agent, because now purple loosestrife is just not really on my radar as a species I have to worry about anymore.
So by saying that, you mean a biologic control, something that research scientists have found out about that's like a natural enemy of the plant, is that
correct?
Is that,
yeah. So there's a couple species of beetle that they researched extensively. And, you know, we have really strict protocols now for researching and, you know, releasing any bugs that basically don't belong here to make sure that they're not going to, that they are really highly specific to the invasive plant that we want to control. And they're not going to jump species, because there are some, you know, native loosestrife species. And so this had been tested really, you know, aggressively for many years before it's been released. And I would say it's probably maybe 10 to 15 years ago that I first started to see it show up in the Berkshires. And they're these little beetles, and they just do a fantastic job. They munch on that purple loosestrife, and we still have it, but we don't get those dense, thick stands of it anymore.
Correct.
And, you know, I remember seeing like calendars with fields of purple loosestrife, and now you don't see those anymore. So.
No, no. And that's, speaking of plants that have a weedy, a strategy for being successful, that I've read that a large purple loosestrife plant can produce 2.7 million seeds per season. And to make matters worse, they float. So they can float downstream and invade a new area pretty easily, which actually our main topic that we want to get to now, stilt grass, I think its seeds can float too. I believe that's possible. They can move in water.
Yes, I recall that is the correct fact. I mean, we often see it moving along, you know, drainage ditches or stream corridors. It definitely, you know, moves well in those like watery type environments.
So stilt grass. Do we say microstegium? Is that correct?
Microstegium.
Okay. Yeah. I you know, Latin is botanical Latin is such a funny one. We all pronounce it differently. So
I know. Yeah. Okay. That's why I try to steer clear, because I'm like, I know I'm just going to botch the names.
So. Yeah. So you've been tackling it for more than 10 years where you are. But it's been in this country for a century or so. It's from various parts of Asia, Japan, China, India, Korea, Malaysia. It probably came in maybe as packing material in crates of porcelain that was imported a century ago. But now it's like as far ranging, as wide ranging as the Florida panhandle, up into New England, out to Michigan, as far west as Missouri. It's gained a lot of ground, and it's an annual grass, a warm season annual grass. So tell us a little about when you met it and what you were like, oh my goodness, and what you tried to do.
Yeah. I had just come back to working for the Nature Conservancy from a little stint in grad school, and I was up at some preserves that we own in Mount Washington, Massachusetts, and saw this grass along the roadside that I was like, oh, I don't really recognize that one. And I happened to be out with a botanist who was doing some work, and they're like, oh, that's stilt grass. And I was like, what's, you know. Right, tell me about this. Like, oh, it's like an invasive, it's new, but it's been here for a couple of years. And I was like, wait, what? I was like, well, how do we have a new invasives? And like, I didn't know about it. And that was like my first shock and my first realization that like, I just needed to keep me and our team like much more apprised and like what's coming, you know, up the pipeline from Connecticut and New York, that is likely to show up in our neighborhood next. And so, and then it was pretty quickly that year when I first found out about it, I started doing some research, and then I had my seasonals, you know, putting together some information. And then we just started to do an extensive mapping, walking the roads of the town of Mount Washington to see how bad it was and where it was and inventorying our properties just to kind of first get that first sense of how bad is it. And I was pretty upset to find out how bad it was already, that it was, you know, and this is like 2010-ish, that it was already pretty widespread along the roadsides.
Right.
And so then it was kind of, you know, trying to get our understanding of control up as quick as possible. And we started cutting, you know, doing just the weed whacking along the roadsides and a lot of trying to reach out to all the partners I could about like, hey, did you know about this new plant, stiltgrass, and we have it here and you should be on the lookout for it. And it really became something I was very focused and driven on for a couple of years, and was able to organize a small like symposium workshop, I think in 2012, to get a bunch of practitioners together to just educate people about this, as well as, you know, thinking about some of the newer plants that people were dealing with. And so-
yeah. So this, as I said, is a warm season annual. So it's an annual that doesn't come up super early. It waits a little while to germinate for more favorable conditions that suit it. And so generally speaking, with an annual weed, let's say an annual weed, like I have many annual weeds that, you know, have come in on garden plants or whatever from the nursery, Galansoga, for instance, or whatever. So annual weed, okay, Margaret will say to herself, I don't want that to flower and set seed. So I'm going to try to interrupt that part of the process, because annual sowing seed means more of them next year, more of that annual yep. next year. But it's not, prove to be quite that simple with the stilt grass. To just weed whack it and prevent it from setting seed didn't seem to do the trick, did it?
No, I mean, it definitely... where we have been doing it for years, like we saw success in that it wasn't taking off. It wasn't like aggressively spreading outside of our focal areas. But it was also not, we weren't really seeing a reduction in like the effort that we would like to see. And we have, you know, that we see with other invasive control projects where you might hit it really hard year one and year two. And the next couple of years, it's just touch up, a little bit of work here and there, you know, instead of a week of time, you're just spending a day or half a day. And we just weren't seeing those results that we had hoped for with stiltgrass. And so I think, again, you know, like how your article kind of talked about, is as the science evolved, like understanding why that cutting alone, like wasn't working, that they can have these, you know, different options for setting seed, and they're lower on the stem, or self-pollination, these things that like our cutting just couldn't actually.
Right. So some plants, probably a lot of plants, have a backup strategy for success. If, you know, if there's a fire, or if whatever happens in nature, I mean, nowadays it's if we mow it down, there's a backup strategy. And this one has these sort of semi-hidden self self-fertilizing, self-pollinating flowers way down below. It has what's called a mixed mating system, which you and I learned about from the scientist we collaborated on, that New York Times story. So it's like, that's the backup. So even if we mow it down, there's some of those hidden seeds down below and they're not getting knocked. So that may be one of the things that makes it succeed. And you were mowing when you were figuring out your timing for when?
Generally, we were mowing in August. We would try to hit it late August to early September, because we felt that that was tall enough where we could really see it and get like a good cutting down to the ground as much as possible. Right. Like if we were cutting it too early, it's really easy to miss into July. Like the plants are just so small. Like, and we could even go back and be like, oh, there was, you know, here's a plant here, there's a plant there that we just couldn't see because the roadsides are usually packed with quite a diversity.
Sure. And so you said, you know, you were keeping it where it was, but you weren't reducing it really substantially. And so I think people are really surprised to learn that sometimes conservation organizations, you know, sort of in the name of the greater good, are making this hard decision to turn to chemical control, which none of us wants to do. But sometimes when you see precious habitat, such as all these acres that you steward in your role, or other people at Nature Conservancy do, sometimes that's what seems to be the better choice. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's what you've done with some of the worst situations with the stilt grass.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, yes, like, you know, we always want to choose the option to control a plant that's going to have the least amount of damage and the most amount of benefit. And so, you know, we have kind of a suite of different tools we'll use depending on the plant, the species, and where the target community is. Like, are we on a roadside, or are we in a sensitive wetland, or in a forest? And so, you know, we look at all of those factors when we decide like what's going to be our best option to start with. And in this case, stilt grass, because it was an annual grass, and because, you know, we know that there's a lot of people who prefer not to use chemicals, that we wanted to start with that as an option. And so we tried that out for a long time, and we probably could have switched sooner, but we realized we weren't getting the results. And so that is when we decided to talk with some of our, you know, colleagues in the field and other professionals about what, if we did use a chemical application, like what would be the best option for us available based on like using the least amount of chemical and having the most direct impacts and the least amount of negative impacts, all of that. And so that is, you know, generally how we'll go. Like, and we'll, you know, you can read labels and you can talk to a lot of different experts to kind of figure out what your best approach is going to be. And it's always like such a learning experience with these control techniques, because you start off using the least amount possible. And how good is your control effort going to be with an ounce? You know, so I mean, when we're looking at our, you know, chemical applications, like we're using extremely small amounts. We're talking about, you know, a couple ounces in a several gallon tank. So it's very diluted and watered down, and they're chemicals that we're very comfortable and very safe, you know, working with it and successfully for years. And, you know, I have like such, you know, I have the benefit of seeing how wonderful these control techniques can work in sensitive habitats where we have been using them to do target applications for decades. And they're thriving with all of these like rare species and
that are coming back. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. So, like there's no, like, there's not like a dead zone, you know?
No.
And so
right. Yeah. So we have just a couple of minutes left. And so you made such a good point in the New York Times story, which was, you don't just go to the store and buy the familiar brand name thing at the big box store and go on a mad spraying campaign at your home. You hire a consultant who has an ecological orientation, who knows all this stuff, and have them evaluate your situation and help you identify the right product. I think that's super important, because it's not one size fits all, and people are random spraying when it's not required, and they're using the wrong things and so forth. So in the wrong habitats. But I just want to leave a little time to say some of the good news, because you're not always fighting invasives, that people can come and visit these incredible properties. And I was like, just looking at even where we are, you know, in the sort of Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts area, there's so many incredible preserves and so forth that are managed by the Nature Conservancy. And so is visitorship, I mean, is there a lot of, is that a lot of the mission too?
Yeah. So, I mean, the Nature Conservancy is, you know, somewhat of a decentralized organization in that each state has its own chapter and kind of, you know, has some flexibility to decide and focus how they, you know, what they want to focus on. And so some states do have more of a focus on recreation and trails and visitor experiences than others do. And so you kind of have a mix of experiences. And in Western Massachusetts, we only have like one or two trails that we really focus our time on because we spend a lot of our time managing rare species habitat. Yes. And so, but yeah, people can visit nature.org and look for places we protect.
And I'll give some links with the transcript of the show.
And so I think that, you know, on, you know, the connectedness between nature and people is very much part of the mission of the Nature Conservancy. But, you know, our roots are definitely in the science and protecting species and places and habitat. And we haven't lost that. And that's, you know, one of the, you know, great things about the Nature Conservancy is trying to bring all of those elements together in conservation. And yeah, there's so many resources for people, you know, on the internet if they want to learn more about invasives or if they, you know, checking with their extension programs for their major universities. They usually have a lot of great resources. A lot of the states have lists of, you know, invasive plants that they should.
And I'll give some good links with the transcript for that. So over on awaytogarden.com with the transcript of this show. So we're out of time, but there's so much more to talk about. And of course, I'm over here. Right near me is my first experience with stiltgrass, and I'm starting with what you advised me in our New York Times story too. I'm starting with the hand pulling because it's a small spot, and see what happens, and then looking to maybe mow or weed whack it late in the summer. So we'll see. But I appreciate your making time today. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, and I wish you the best of luck with that stiltgrass. You can succeed if you stay with it.
It's small, so I'm alerted to it thanks to you. So thank you.
Great.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbooks, small gift books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. And on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy weeding and gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.